number of years ago, Major General Furlong, whose career as an Army officer led him into many parts of the world, became deeply interested in the descent of religions and the various meetings and intermeetings of these streams of spiritual conviction. And he did a series of books dealing with this subject. And in one of them, he includes a very extensive chart which folds many times and becomes a diagram of a great river of beliefs. And he called this chart the River of Faiths. And he attempted to explain by means of this chart descending through history how religions came to the modern world, the backgrounds of what we believe, and the gradual building of the structures of faith which are of concern to all of us. Perhaps the most interesting point that he made has value now. Each person in his own religious life, more or less, lives through this entire chart. Just as the human being coming into birth passes in the fetal and embryonic states through practically all of the preceding kingdoms of nature before he attains his human structure, so it seems that the human being after birth, in his thinking, in his emotions, in his graspings for consolation and confidence, goes through subjectively the entire quest of man for spiritual value. Now, it is true that each individual is largely influenced by his own tradition, by his own experiences, and by the prevailing creeds and the cultures in which he lives. But these do not provide the entire answer to his spiritual needs. Something must come from his own contemplation of life. And General Furlong was of the conviction that the streams of religion began in man's contemplation, his interior effort to integrate the experiences and processes of his own life in relation to its environment. But through these strivings, he forms his religious conviction. At least by this means, the person approaches religion dynamically. He is not merely an historian of faith. He is not one who simply accepts the dominant cults of his day without question, selects one, and tries to live by it. There is more than this. There is this estimation of need, the individual's own requirement. And he searches for something that meets this requirement, having an individuality about his seeking, which we are all permitted to have, but very few of us make much use of it. We are simply willing to drop into a religious niche somewhere, much as we accept on face value most of the other so-called realities of life. So I think General Furlong's position is more or less well taken. Each person who is open-minded and thoughtful begins to experience the needs of faith. Unfortunately, for most of us, this experience is not well-oriented. We do not have the necessary personal instruments by which we can seek religious consolation with any perspective, with any certain assistance from the available religious sources of mankind. One answer might be, and I think someday could be given more thought, namely that some basic training in the comparative principles of religion should be included in education. Now, I do not mean creedal religion. I do not mean that education should insist upon any belief, but that it should provide the individual with some comprehension of the beliefs available in order that he may choose more intelligently. I've talked to many persons on the problems of religion, and the majority of persons, particularly in this country, have absolutely no conception of any faith or religion other than that with which they are most immediately familiar. They are not able to even approach comparative religion. Yet without such assistance, it is difficult for a person to make a complete choice of his own believing. He does not know what is available to him. If you were going into a store to buy a dress or a suit, you would probably not be satisfied if the store could offer you only one to choose from. You would not want to buy your goods where there is no selection possible. You would therefore look for a larger store where perhaps some unsuspected design, pattern, or color might interest you. If the person is perfectly willing to go into a restaurant that serves only one item of diet, fully aware that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday it will be beans, if he is satisfied with this, then he has no essential problem, but we would regard him as somewhat lacking in, shall we say, taste in foods. If this same individual traveling always took the same trip, he would not be in a position to tell where the best scenery is to be found. He can only continue to tell how wonderful the area is which he has explored. If he has never engaged in any thoughtfulness about philosophy, he is scarcely in a position to know what philosophy has to offer him, or to weigh the values of different schools in terms of his own requirements. And so we can go down through almost every product in life. The automotive industry would not be nearly so successful if only one color and one style of car was always available. We like to have an opportunity to compare, to examine, and to think. But in our spiritual problem, the only way in which we can achieve this end is by a very dramatic effort of our own. We have to break through a common pattern of inertia and become rugged individualists if we expect to find more than that which is generally offered. Thus, in religion, we have not made use of all of its wonders and its beauties and its possibilities. Also, I think that we are limited to a measure by the fact that most religious groups, in practice, are more or less dogmatic. This is not necessarily true of the better and more informed exponents, but it is true of the majority of a following. This following is devout and comes to the inevitable conclusion that its own selection is the best. Thus, if we live in a community in which there is a common agreement as to what is best, we are not only not inclined to search further, but our efforts to find are hampered or interfered with by prevailing limitations of perspective. The study of comparative religion, therefore, is not to be regarded merely as a grubbing through ancient documents for no vital purpose, but rather is a way of showing us what is possible in the form of belief. And also, each of these different faiths has its own logic, its own reasonableness, its own traditional support for that which it does believe. Unless we examine the logic, we are again short-changing ourselves. We are not supposed merely to believe because we are told to. We are given an opportunity to determine why what we believe is peculiarly necessary to us. If we do not take advantage of this privilege, we again limit our perspective unnecessarily. Major General Furlong also points out another interesting situation that arises, namely that this search for larger perspective, this effort to sort of outgrow a local situation, requires an attitude on the part of the believer. He has to have a certain natural inquiry. And as civilization goes on, becoming ever more defensive and protective of peoples, individual inquiry begins to disappear. Just as the physical pioneer has no longer a place when nations become highly civilized, so the intellectual pioneer has increasing difficulties as his culture becomes more tightly systematized. The inducements to see are not as great as they should be, and only criticism may reward the inquisitive individual. In this nation, for example, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 or 160 million human beings. This large collective group is probably more polyglot than most other social integrations which we can examine. When we think of Germany, we think largely of Germans. When we think of England, we think of Englishmen. But when we think of America, we think of Americans, but we know that these Americans come from countless other areas, that they have come here and established their ways of life from a variety of backgrounds. We are also quite obviously convinced that some of these backgrounds linger longer than others. And in most of our large communities, the foreign population groups have still a tendency to segregate, to remain somewhat to themselves, to preserve their own ways of life. Only a few days ago, for instance, the French people in this community celebrated Bastille Day. And there was something about this that awakened nostalgia in thousands of persons of French descent, even though they may have been born in this country. Thus, we are really a very complicated people, a people with many different cultural patterns, which are not dead, which have not ceased, possibly because America as a nation has never really advanced a powerful culture of its own. These people are left to drift very largely. They maintain their own culture because there is no clear indication of any other pattern to follow. So if we are composed, as we know that we are, of the peoples of more than 150 nations, if our cultures root back to a great many different sources, this is all the more reason why the individual, in whose life stream perhaps a number of foreign courses still flow, that the individual should have the opportunity of finding various inspirational material from different basic sources suitable to his own peculiar needs. In the process also of developing this national pattern, as we call it, we have presented ourselves with a greater complexity of problems than probably any other nation on earth. We recognize this in the extreme difficulty that we have in being fair to various people and various social groups. As a national institution, we must adjust all our legislations to the tremendous areas of specialization which exist within this country. Realizing, consequently, that our people are probably subject to more psychic stress in a wider variety of psychic patterns than most other civilizations. We have needs which must be met with larger concepts, with deeper insight, and with a broader recognition of the requirements of the growing individual. Our Western way of life also seems to invite us to a very rapid form of industrial and intellectual growth. Persons in various social strata today are apt to shift about very suddenly. The individual of comparatively slight means, and therefore perhaps of slight insight, because he has never felt compelled to enlarge his perspective, suddenly finds himself an administrating power over larger means, or finds himself advanced into other levels of his business. The problem of being born, living, and dying in one small pattern has been rather well broken up in this country. So the needs of Monday may be quite different from the needs of Tuesday. And the rapid shift and change in our ways calls upon greater internal resource on our own part, so that we may adjust not only externally, but internally. For if we do not adjust mentally, morally, psychologically, ethically, and emotionally, our adjustment is not adequate. Where we cannot adjust, we become confused. And the greater the degree of confusion, the more easily we are injured by the things that happen to us. So to find spiritual consolation in this Western world probably means that we need a broader area of religious understanding than most people have as yet developed. Now some will say, and with a very large degree of accuracy, that essentially all religions teach about the same thing. Therefore, we should be able to find in any one of them all the consolation that is necessary to us. In principle, this is probably true. But in activity and in action, we find it is not quite as obviously satisfactory as we might assume. It is true that most faiths teach the same basic essentials. But usually they teach these essentials in a slightly different symbolical pattern. It is not what an institution teaches that is the primary and ultimate problem. It is how the person depending upon that institution is able to interpret for himself what it teaches. Thus, individuals of different types of minds are not able to accept one interpretation for all the different principles that arise. We know this. It is no question of acceptance or rejection of a theory. We know this in Christendom alone, but we know that Christianity, to meet the needs of many different individuals, has already become highly sectarian, and that today probably a dozen or 20 major divisions and nearly 500 minor sects disseminate Christian religious doctrine through the peoples of Christendom. This means that certain interpretations are more or less essential to the individual. He instinctively goes to one that seems to be nearest to his own need. Today, the mature selection of religion is much greater than it used to be. In many faiths, the individual was born into a doctrine and never conceived the possibility of moving from it. But today there is a greater tendency of mature people to choose their faiths. And in the choice of this nature, a certain power within man is necessary. It is again as though you went to a store to buy some products. You are conditioned by your attitudes toward these products. And the thoughtful person tries to find out which products are the best. He may succeed or he may not succeed, but he undoubtedly develops allegiances. We have today probably 20 or 25 different kinds of soaps and detergents for washing machines. Each of these brands has a positive following that will not buy anything else. They do not know why. Each is convinced that particular brand is a little better than the others. Perhaps they've been told so. Perhaps that's the television program they turn on. But whatever it is, they have this conviction and a wonderful loyalty. And I have wondered sometimes whether all the detergents didn't come from one vat and the only difference was the packaging. But that most people would not admit. And just as they are not certain as to which soap will prove the greatest cleanser, so they may not be quite certain what faith proves the greatest cleanser. Whatever it is, however, they are certain in their own minds that they have a peculiar insight into these problems. Now, as we do have this inevitable tendency of people to develop loyalty to certain ideas, it is rather important for those people and for their own good that these loyalties have certain foundation in fact. We are unhappy today because of the numerous loyalties that are not justified or not substantially sustained. So General Furlong tried to help to create a pattern of knowledge by which we could overcome certain basic prejudice and try to establish a religious conviction, perhaps as our ancient forebears did, upon some kind of a method of estimation or of evaluation, which would help to make things as they should be. So he went back to the very dawn of time, when man was an extremely primitive being, perhaps at that mysterious point, religionless, without any essential way of determining the spiritual equation in his own life. He moved around probably much as the utter materialist of today, but with fewer faculties and facilities. He lived merely because he had been born, and therefore he had to continue until death relieved him of whatever complications had arisen. He lived by hunting because he had to eat. Gradually, he became aware of the need of clothing to protect himself against the rigors of the world around him. In the course of time, habitation emerged as a necessity, and he began to enlarge the caves and the sides of hills. And little by little, his own internal pressures, the dawn of consciousness within himself, led him to the inevitable selections which have become the foundation of our entire concept of progress. Somewhere in this mystery also, another type of faculty within himself began to emerge. And this faculty probably was not quite the religious power or faculty we know today. It was rather fear, or perhaps a strange inquisitiveness, an effort to explain things that could not easily be explained, and also in this process a kind of inferiority complex developed, because the individual found himself as a very small being in a very large process of which he was only a fractional part. And in his studies, in his contemplations, in these days before he could even make a scratching on a wall to indicate his thoughts, the individual found himself confronted by forces representing various procedures in the world around him. One of the forces that he probably discovered at an early time in his contemplation was the sun, this tremendous ball of light and fire, which moved daily across the sky, and when it departed, left behind it the darkness of night, in which in due time and course the stars, or perhaps the moon, became visible to him and took over the management of the nocturnal period of his existence. The sun was a wonderful thing. It was all-powerful. These primitive people did not know what it was. They saw merely a great ball of light that seemed to move constantly, which seemed to bring with it the dawn, in which the whole world awoke from sleep. This light ball awakened existence. It also gave him the opportunity to go forth and hunt, or to perform the various needs which could only be met by him in a period of daylight. You can imagine that to this primitive man, the sun came to be very important. He couldn't control it. He couldn't fathom it. He couldn't reach out and touch it. It was something that went on and on and on. He had his beginnings and his ends, but the sun did not. It kept its pattern age after age, always a great light moving through the sky. Well, it would be quite natural and proper for a primitive being, comparatively without reasoning resources, to sense in this thing something wonderful, something beyond his control, something that also seemed to serve him in a wonderful way, for this sun was his great friend, although in the desert it could become his enemy. Still, for the most part, it was friendly. It served his needs. It helped him to do things. And it became a symbol of his own survival. And with it went the power of light. And light has become, in the course of time, one of our greatest key thoughts in symbolism and in intellect. We think now of enlightened persons as one who have a kind of light in themselves. And we recognize radiance in a personality as a very wonderful and helpful attribute. So primitive man began to worship the sun. He began to see in it all of the wonders of life. He began to give thanks for it. He began to depend upon it, and to sense that this dependence was the one thing that was real, that all other things might fail, but the sun, the moon, and the stars would go on their way. Thus they became a symbol of continuance and seemed to reveal or represent some wonderful, orderly process greater than he could comprehend. It would be only natural, therefore, for him to bestow upon the sun all of his own attributes and many others, until this became a wonderful, luminous, radiant being upon whom he could depend continuously for his help in time of trouble, to the ripening of his harvest, to the sprouting of grain. And the sun became a symbol of the life power everywhere present in existence. Now, in the course of ages, sun worship gradually refined itself. We do not worship the sun anymore as such, but the elements of sun worship have not ceased in religion. And down through the ages, this great stream of conviction continued, modified, augmented, refined, as our own knowledge increased, and brought into a more complete pattern with the gradual rise of astronomical sciences. Yet with it all, the principle of the sun has come down to us into our modern religion, into our present believing in all things, in the concept of the worship of light, of the principle of light, that light represents the power to penetrate the unknown, and that the light, as St. George, has finally slain the dragon of darkness and of ignorance, and light became truth, and darkness became error. And we have always believed that there was a light that lighteth the darkness, and that this light is God. Therefore, we will frequently refer to God as light. And this comes down to us from this old stream of human belief. Now, man also exploring around him and estimating the values of things that occurred, it came to another interesting symbol. And that was his instinctive recognition of the mystery of procreation, the power of living things to generate, to reproduce their kind. The little bird breaking through the shell of the egg, the birth of new beings in nature, the mysterious process of the continuity of life through generation, fascinated primitive man. It seemed that in this some mysterious magical agent was involved, and the worship of generation was early involved in magic. Yet the fact remained that one of the most powerful forces in the universe was that which kept things going, kept them reproducing their kind, causing them to grow, causing them to continue, to bring each year the new harvest out of the earth, that things growing from their seed produced in turn their own seed, and that this went on and on and on. So out of the concept of this came a recognition of a universal mystery of procreativity, a mystery of life begetting life. And all that had to do with this begetting, as it related to man, became sacred, became mysterious and wonderful, and was regarded as a gift or a bestowal of some power invisible and superior to man. A little later in his growth, man discovered fire. And we have the rise of the religions of fire. We find the altar flame burning everywhere, whether it was upon the altars of the ancient tribes of Israel or in the burning candles on the altars of the modern church. The worship of fire, all that it meant, all of the mystery that it implied, fire came from nowhere. Fire burned out and died. But although 1,000 fires died, fire did not die. Everywhere, by a magic power, it could be called forth. Everywhere, it became either a source of light or of a consuming power. And this mystery of fire, flickering, mysterious, formless, ever-present, this mysterious and strange thing which brought light into the cave where the sun could not reach, which warmed the coldness of winter, and which gradually came to assist in the preparation of food. Fire was a very wonderful thing. And fire to these ancient peoples seemed to represent the presence of a power, the power of heat, the power of warmth. They discovered that when they died, their bodies became cold, that a fire went out of them. And so, to many very primitive peoples, there was the belief that a fire burned in the heart of man, and that this fire was his spirit. And the uniting of the concept of spirit and fire gradually gained much favor in the thinkings of primitive peoples. And as a result, we have a pyrolatry, or the worship of the principle of fire and its symbol, which is the upright triangle. Now, while all these things were going on in the thinkings of men, other primitive and original discoveries were also brought to consideration. Another great discovery was the earth. Not the earth just simply because it was a surface upon which primitive man wandered about through forests and jungles and along the shores of lakes and streams, but the earth itself became wonderful. The worship of the earth as the great mother originated at a very remote time. Why? Because man clung to the earth. He held on to it. He tried to have a little part of it for his own home, for his own protection. The earth grew his food. And the sense of concept was that he had come himself from the earth, and to the earth he returned again in the grave mound. And in the grave he seemed to go back into the earth. And therefore the grave became a gateway leading down somewhere under the earth, where there might be a place where ghosts and shadows lived. But the earth became, in a sense, the source of all nutrition, the security, the firmness beneath our feet, the very source of our ability to survive at all. As a planet, it was not known to these people, but as an element, they could take it in their hands and allow the rich, dark soil to fall through their fingers. They also saw the roots of plants clinging desperately to the earth for life. They saw the rain making the earth fertile. And from it all came this wonderful veneration for the great earth principle, the mother of mysteries, from whose eternal womb all life came, and into the darkness of which all life in turn went back when its course was finished. The earth became therefore a model of temple and house and of prison and of graveyard. It was all these different things. But as a principle, earth remained. And gradually as man grew a little wiser, he bound the concept of his own body with the earth. His body was made of the substances of the earth, and it was sustained by the source of its own substances. So the worship of earth, or of nature particularly, and all natural phenomena, took a large place in man's thinking. And at one time the Egyptians had a deity, Serapis, to signify this wonderful world of nature. And at Alexandria, where his shrine stood, they had a great image of him, and this image was composed entirely of natural things. The body was made up of grain and fruit and flowers, and all living creatures were wound into this mysterious emblem, which thereby became a symbol of nature itself. So we have these beginning streams, which men in their own concept felt to be important. Now, one thing that man recognized also was the rapidity with which all things seem to pass away. Things change and disappear, and they are no more. And among those things that went was man himself. And the great God of Babylonia cried out, "Let me be remembered." And this desire to be remembered, perhaps based upon the lingering memory that man had of his own forebears. He liked to remember his father, and his father would tell of his grandfather. And this man then did not want to be forgotten. He wanted his children to tell of him, and their children in turn to tell of their grandfather, and so on. So in the cries of the ancient cuneiform inscriptions of Babylonia and Chaldea, the thought is constantly implied, let us not be forgotten. Let some part of us belong to that which never shall die. A man looking around for the symbol of this hope of endurance found two elements working together. He found that with his own hand he could make little carvings, little tracings with a hard rock upon a softer one, in which he could make pictures telling about himself, telling about the world he lived in. And these pictures he made upon the surface of enduring rock. And out of the combination and psychology of the idea that rock became the source of recording, that which was to endure, endured longest upon rock. And out of this came the rock inscription, the gradual carving of glyphs that we can no longer read, but which in their own time meant something. They meant survival. They meant that memory would go on remembering, and that the children on the rock picture could trace the doings of their ancestors. So the worship of stone the worship of great monolithic rocks raised in circles, as at Stonehenge or at Karnak in Brittany, or out in the jungles of Africa or Asia. These rocks were the symbol of endurance, things that would go on and would never die. And out of this came the worship of stone, and of stone monuments, and of obelisks, and the building of pyramids, and all of these great rock projects. They were created to the concept of immortality, to the fact that something would go on. So even today, men follow this instinctively, whether they realize it or not. A few days ago, happening to be down near the Civic Center, I saw one of these great demolishing machines hurling an iron ball against the wall of a building that was slowly crumbling. This building had evidently at one time been an heroic endeavor in the construction of our city. They had not yet torn down or demolished the entrance door, a kind of semi-Grecian arch that perhaps showed more of courage than of architectural skill. But over the door was a man's name. This building was the building he had built. In a few more minutes, this great iron ball would lower this with the rest. And this project, which had stood maybe 50 or 75 years in memory of this man who had built it, would be laid with the dust of ages. But the man had put his name there just exactly for the same reason that our primitive ancestor carved circles, squares, and galloping bison upon the wall of a cave. He did it to be remembered. It was his little bid to immortality. Perhaps he had had to practically burden his own soul in order to get the funds to build this building. It was his monument. It was also his grave marker. And now time was to take it away. But his instinct was there. This instinct never to die, to be remembered through the things we do. And this is still an essential part of our religion. Today we perhaps use it differently. We do not make so much of the stone. Perhaps rather today we try to mold our names and superscriptions upon the hearts of our children. We try to hope that they will carry on the careers that we leave unfinished. We build great enterprises as the ancients built their monuments in stone. And we hope that those who come after us will always remember that this vast project was originally created by some one person, that this person, John Doe, should never be forgotten. So it goes. And this monument problem, this tracing of things in stone as a symbol of permanence, resulted in the worship of stone. And it did become a great faith in ancient times, as is referred to in the Bible by the monument that was set up in Egypt. And wherever a great people has flourished, it has carved its records deep into stone, whether it is the Roman Forum, or the Egyptian complex at Karnak, or in the Great Wall of China, or in the pagodas of Japan, or the mosques of Islam. Always there is the name, the word, the inscription that must go on. The worship of stone, therefore, became a symbol of the worship of memory. It became the not to forget that which is the source of ourselves, that which has helped to build or to make possible the continuance of our own way of life. Again, the ancients, in their studies and researches, became aware of something else. This something else that they became aware of was motion. Vitality moved into their concept, gradually taking over a greater part than had previously been recognized. That which belongs to the animal or human way of life is most alive when it moves. The ancients considered sleep a kind of death, a thought which is carried into the Bible in the words of St. Paul. But motion was everywhere present. Motion as a power was not visible. To the ancients, motion was perhaps most clearly and universally recognized by the motion of air, wind.